This morning, we are going to be finishing up a series. Remember what we talked before about when Kelly and I were first coming on board, we talked about how I tend to do things and I tend to teach through whole books of the Bible. There are some books, though, that are fairly long. And so what a lot of people who follow the same approach that I do, a lot of times what we do is we break up long book studies into chunks. And so Matthew, we're going to break it up into three different studies. And so this week we're going to finish up our first series in Matthew. Next week we're going to start a brand new series in the first few chapters of Genesis, which I think should be fun. So so this week, though, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 10. Before you can be turning there, does anybody know the first three rules of real estate?
Location.
Very good.
Is it?
Those are the first three rules of real estate. Location, location, location. Anybody know what the first three rules of Bible study are?
Location, location, location.
Almost. Context, context, context. More mistakes are made in studying the Bible by taking things out of context than just about anything else. And when we take a passage and we look at it in context, a lot of times it helps us avoid a lot of confusion and a lot of mistaken ideas and everything. So I want to show you an example of that this morning as we start out. So let's start off with Matthew 10. Everybody there? We have it above here for anyone who doesn't have a Bible. We have Bibles available. We have giant print Bibles available too if you need that. Okay, so Matthew 10:1. Jesus called his 12 disciples together and gave them authority to cast out evil spirits and to heal every kind of disease and illness. Here are the names of the 12 apostles, and it goes on from there. Now, that's not a bad way to start off, right? Kind of interesting. Right off the bat, we have, you know, he's designating disciples as apostles, and it's very interesting. However, go back just a few verses. Let's start with chapter 9, verse 36. And you'll remember this from a couple weeks ago. When he saw the crowds, speaking of Jesus, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were confused and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. He said to his disciples, "The harvest is great, but the workers are few. So pray to the Lord who is in charge of the harvest. Ask him to send more workers into his fields." Jesus called his 12 disciples together and gave them authority to cast out evil spirits and to heal every kind of disease and illness. Does that have a different context now? Mm-hmm. You see a little bit different understanding of that? Before, it's just like when we read it for the first time, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, he's pointing to certain disciples and apostles and he's giving them with... When we read it in context, though, why is he doing that? Sending workers into the field. Yeah, the prayer is already being answered, isn't it? He's sending workers in the field. Why is he sending workers into the field?
Because there's few
of them. And why do we need workers in the field? Why do we?
The harvest is great.
The harvest is great. Remember we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Why is that? What's important about that?
People coming to Christ.
And why is that important?
Love, compassion.
Because we love them. Because he loves them. Remember, he looked at them and he had compassion on them. It all comes back to loving God, loving the people. And if we really love God and love people, it results in what? It results in ministry. It results in carrying the message to people, serving people in the church and outside the church. It all comes back to love. The reason why Jesus is sending them out is because he looked at the people and he saw them as sheep without a shepherd, confused and helpless, and he had compassion on them. So what's he doing? He's doing something about it, right? He's sending them out. He's sending people out. Well, and when we read the scriptures in context, we see it's not that we're not going to see necessarily the same things, but we see a depth. We see there's a richness to it that we miss if we don't study it in context. There's a reason why he's sending these people out, and it's because of the need. And the need is important because he truly loves the people. So let's look at this. Let's get into verse 10. Let's read that again. Jesus called his 12 disciples together and gave them authority to cast out evil spirits and to heal every kind of disease and illness. Here are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, also called Peter. Then Andrew, Peter's brother. James, son of Zebedee. John, James's brother. Philip, Bartholomew. Thomas, Matthew the tax collector. James, son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, Judas Iscariot, who later betrayed him. Now, he calls the 12 disciples, gives them authority to cast out evil spirits and to heal every kind of disease and illness. Do you think there's a reason why he's giving them this authority and this power? If I called three guys, designate them as assistants, give them all tool belts, give them all hammers and nails, is there something that I'm intending them to do with those things? Or is that just kind of decoration?
No.
They got a tool belt and a hammer. They're supposed to, you guys remember Barney Fife and the Andy Griffith Show? You know, it always kind of, and he had his gun right there, you know, he'd be pretty proud of his gun, just one bullet.
Yes.
Right. So, you know, if you get a hammer, a tool belt, a hammer, a nail, with Don Barney Fife, you only get one nail, right? Is that just to, you know, kind of show people, yeah, the boss gave me a hammer, I got a nail here. What's the purpose of that?
To build something,
actually do something with it, right? It's not just a status symbol, it's not just, oh, wow, hey, out of everybody, Jesus called us, designated us as apostles. No, there's a purpose to this. He intends, if God equips us with something, he intends for us to do something with what he equips us with, right? It's not really a radical idea. Does that mean that what God equips us with, he intends us to do something with it? Probably so, huh? Well, let's see what these guys are supposed to do. Verse 5. Jesus sent out the 12 apostles with these instructions. Don't go to the Gentiles or the Samaritans, but only to the people of Israel, God's lost sheep. Go and announce to them that the kingdom of heaven is near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cure those with leprosy, and cast out demons. Give as freely as you have received. He starts off saying, don't go to the Gentiles or the Samaritans. Just go to the lost house of Israel. Is it just Gentiles and Samaritans? Is it just tough luck for them? Just not time for him, Rich said. That's absolutely right. Interesting. Who has the plan? God does. Not that it's bad, wrong for us to plan, but our plans are always dependent on his plan, right? Always subject to... His plan doesn't change. Our plan is always subject to change, right? Always subject to modification and revision depending on his plan. Does his plan always make perfect sense to us at the time? No. Often it doesn't. Often it's like, what? Now, the disciples, obviously, I don't think they had any problem with not going to the Gentiles and Samaritans because they didn't know that was eventually going to be the plan anyway. But sometimes God kind of gives us qualifications like this. It's kind of, what? Wait, what? And then we really find out, who do we trust? Do we trust God with the big picture of the plan? Or is it like, no, it has to make sense. It has to make sense to me. I was talking with somebody just recently, and we were talking about issues of faith and everything. And well, that was one of the things we were talking about, is that at some point we have to confess, I'm not God. And if I insist on everything making crystal clear sense to me, then basically what I'm saying is, until I'm God, until I have the complete understanding the way God does, I'm not going to believe anything. And that's a dangerous place, a dangerous standard to have, because we're not ever going to have that kind of understanding, not in this lifetime at least. So, yeah, things don't always make sense to us, but we need to trust that God has the whole plan. And he has a plan here. The Jewish people were originally supposed to be a light to the Gentiles. They were supposed to carry God's light to all of the Gentiles, and they didn't fulfill that. And so Jesus, in a way, is giving them another chance to do that. They can go from the old covenant people of God to the new covenant people of God and once again be a light to the Gentiles. Ultimately, most of them didn't do that, and so that was fulfilled through Christ and the church. But this is a very important time for the Jewish people, and so he tells the disciples, don't go to the Gentiles or Samaritans. Not time for that yet. Focus on the people of Israel. And notice what they're supposed to be doing. Go and announce to them, verse 7, that the kingdom of heaven is near. Heal the sick. Raise the dead. That's exciting, isn't it? Cure those with leprosy. Cast out demons. Remember it said that he gave them authority? This is the authority. Remember, we talked about this. We talked about this before. When Jesus came on the scene, Jesus has all authority, right? And so when he comes on the scene, what does he immediately start doing when his ministry begins? He is casting out demons. He's casting out demons. He's healing the sick. He's raising the dead. It's the invasion of light into darkness, of life into death. We've talked about that a few times. And so when he casts out demons, he is showing very clearly the authority and the power that light has over the darkness, that God has over his enemies. Now, this is like the next wave of the invasion. Now it's not just Jesus doing that, just himself. Now he's sending out the apostles. You guys go out and do this. Heal the sick. Cast out demons. Raise the dead. I mean, this is more of this explosion, this invasion. It's radical, it's revolutionary, and it's intended to be. And so this is very exciting. It's the next step, next phase. We've been talking about going through this chrysalis phase, and then we're going to go on to the next phase. Now, this is the next phase in Jesus' mission, and now he's incorporating the apostles and sending them out to do it. Give as freely as you've received. Jesus didn't charge them for this. They're not supposed to be going out and trying to make money off that. We were talking about different groups in our Tuesday night study discussion group, Growing Stronger. And this last week we were talking about Scientology. And one of the things about Scientology, many of you are probably aware of this, they've had specials on this on TV and everything, but Scientology, there's a whole thing that they're focused on in that they believe is helping people. It's this process, it's called auditing, that they go through. The thing is, though, you have to pay for it. You have to pay a lot of money for it, and a lot of people end up using up their entire life savings. It's almost like an addiction, because it costs thousands of dollars and thousands of dollars and tens of thousands of dollars and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it never ends. It's ongoing. You have to keep on paying more and more and more to try to work through all the phases and all the steps and climb all the ladders and jump through all the hoops and go through all the books and the tape series and all that stuff. And it's, you know, my question is, if this is so beneficial to humanity, why not give it away for free? And that's what Jesus is saying here. You've received freely, give it away freely. This is not a money-making scheme. This is we're doing this for the people. In fact, he says, verse 9, don't take any money in your money belts. No gold, silver, or even copper coins. Don't carry a traveler's bag with a change of clothes and sandals or even a walking stick. Now, are these permanent instructions?
No.
No. Doesn't mean that anybody who goes out in ministry, you're not supposed to have any money. Get rid of all your extra clothes. That's not it at all. This is a training. It's on-the-job training. And he's doing this for a specific reason. Many of the instructions that we're going to read here in the next few verses. We have a lot of ground to cover, so I'm kind of moving through this. But many of the instructions that we're going to read are only for this specific mission. That's one of the things. In a few weeks, we're going to start a series on Tuesday night, How to Study the Bible. And it's really important that we understand some of the rules for how to accurately study the Bible. And one of the things that's really important for us to understand when we're studying the Bible is to figure out who is being spoken to and what the context is. Because all of the Bible is written for us, but it's not all written to us. And sometimes, like this, these are instructions given specifically to the disciples at a specific time for a specific purpose. Even later on, when he sends them out again, he'll tell them. He said, remember before when I told you not to take any money with you and not to do this, not to... He said, okay, now, if you have money, take it with you. If you have, you know, extra walking stuff, you know, take it with you. Take extra clothes with you. So he'll change... But this is for a specific purpose right now. He wants to build their faith. He wants to show them that they don't have to be dependent on a big budget. They don't have to be dependent on, you know, on anything that they're going to be taken care of. So he says, when you go out, don't take any money with you. Don't take extra clothes with you. Don't extra sandals or walking stick, any of this. And he goes on, don't hesitate to accept hospitality because those who deserve to be fed. Whenever you enter a city or village, search for a worthy person and stay in his home until you leave town. When you enter the home, give it your blessing. If it turns out to be a worthy home, let your blessing stand. If it is not, take back the blessing. Now, for some of you who aren't familiar with this passage, that may sound a little odd. What's all going on here? First of all, he says, don't hesitate to accept hospitality. Many of us oftentimes have a hard time accepting help. especially with the work ethic that many of us have grown up with, where you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, you are self-sufficient, you know, you take care of yourself. That's the way we're used to thinking about life. And so a lot of times it's really hard for us to accept help. It's really hard for us to be in the position where we need to accept help. But what we need to realize, now there's a difference between just, some people are too eager to accept help sometimes. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm going to lay back, everybody help me. You know, that's another problem. But sometimes we need to realize that not refusing to accept help, not being willing to accept help, a lot of times it's just another form of pride. That, no, I will not accept help. I have to do it. I have to do it myself. And that's not healthy. And a lot of times if we have that problem, God will intentionally put us in the place where we have to receive help. Just to teach us that, no, sometimes you have to be, a lot of us are much more comfortable being the one to help others, to hand, you know, give a helping hand to others, than to be the one who receives a helping hand. But God will put us on both ends of that at times. And so he's saying, don't hesitate to accept hospitality. What they were supposed to do, they were supposed to look for a worthy person and accept their hospitality. And when they entered the house, they gave it their blessing. And then if it turned out not to be worthy, they took their blessing back. What they understood this terminology in their context. What they were looking for, Jesus is emphasizing the worthy person because they aren't supposed to be looking for the wealthiest person. They aren't supposed to be looking for the person with the biggest, nicest house. And say, okay, let's get this person to help us. And then, you know, they've got all the servants and, you know, a nice bed and, you know, all the accommodations, all the amenities, right? They're not supposed to be to check it out on Yelp ahead of time and figure out, you know, check out all the reviews. And this would be the nicest place. It's whoever offers help. And that may not necessarily be where they might want to stay. But if the person is willing to help them, then the idea is they're worthy. And so you stay with them. And by their presence, they are blessing that household. And then if for some reason the person is not worthy, maybe they have ulterior motives, maybe they don't have the right, you know, they're not really willing, then they leave and they remove the blessing. That's the whole idea. But they should be willing to stay with and work with the people that are willing to help them.
How do you take back a blessing?
That's remember... You leave the house, exactly. That's exactly right, what Rohana says. Remember, if you look back in the Old Testament, remember when Jacob was sold into slavery? Joseph. When Joseph was sold into slavery, remember he ended up in Potiphar's household? And his presence was a blessing to Potiphar. Potiphar prospered because of Joseph being there. We see that a lot in the Old Testament. The presence of a prophet or of a person of God would be a blessing. Abraham was a blessing at times to different people. And we see that in different... Jacob was a blessing to Laban's household when he went and was a part of Laban. Remember Laban, he was taking care of Laban's stuff, and Laban was just getting rich and prospering because of Jacob's. And so that's the idea. And they would have understood that. It sounds a little odd to us now, but it was the very presence of the disciples that was the blessing. So the way you remove the blessing is by leaving. You go someplace else. Yeah. And it says, verse 14 continues, if any household or town refuses to welcome you or listen to your message, then it is your responsibility to make sure that they listen to your message and make sure that they accept it. Right? Is that what it says?
No.
That's not? Whose responsibility is it to listen to the message? It's their responsibility. It's their responsibility to hear the message. It's their responsibility to consider the message. It's their responsibility to respond to the message. It is not our responsibility to make sure what the outcome is. The outcome is not our responsibility. We need to always remember that, because a lot of times we get focused on the outcome, on the response, as if that's what we are producing. That we're the ones we're producing a certain outcome. We're getting someone to say a prayer or sign on the dotted line or whatever, read a scripture passage or whatever it is. That's not our responsibility. Who is the one who works in the heart and the mind?
God.
We don't even have direct access to the heart and the mind, really. What is our responsibility?
To make the message.
message known.
To make the message known. To do that faithfully, right? To pray. To pray for people, to make the message known. Are we responsible for how we make the message known?
Yeah,
Paul talks a lot about this, right? I have become all things to all people so that I might win some. To the Jews, I am as a Jew. To the Gentiles, I am as a Gentile. So we need to be thoughtful about it. We need to be we need to make sure that we're communicating the language that someone can hear. We need to put, because we love people, right? We have compassion. They're sheep without a shepherd. They need a relationship with God. And so we want to be as thoughtful in the way we present the message as we possibly can. We don't present it based on our preference and the language that we like to talk. We communicate it in a way that they will hear it, that will make sense to them. But whose responsibility is it to respond, to hear it, to listen and respond? It's theirs. And we can't take that responsibility away from them. It's the same way, you know, you don't say, I learned. A teacher doesn't say, oh yeah, I learned those students. The teacher teaches, right? Whose responsibility is it to learn?
Students.
Yeah. So it's, and when we take that responsibility on, we get frantic and we get really pointed and we start coming across like hardcore salespeople, like I'm going to get you to accept this deal, you know? And we start coming on, yeah, it's a hard sales kind of approach. And what we end up doing is people slam the doors on us, maybe not literally, but mentally and emotionally. And a lot of times it's our fault because we're taking on too much responsibility. Where when we realize that it's God who is in charge of the whole process and the people have to respond, then we can just relax. We can be faithful and obedient, but just relax. Because we're not going to change anybody's heart or mind anyway. All we do is faithfully, as effectively as possible, share the message. And then the rest is up to God and the person. So he says, verse 14, let's read that again correctly. If any household or town refuses to welcome you or listen to your message, shake its dust from your feet as you leave. We're familiar, many of us, with that terminology, but a lot of times we don't understand why they say that. It was a Jewish custom at that time with very pious, very devout Jews. The Pharisees would always do this. When they left a Gentile area or a Samaritan area, someplace that was non-Jewish, and went into Jewish territory, they would stop and they would shake the dust off their clothes and off their feet. The idea was they didn't even want pagan dust. They didn't want to even carry pagan dust with them into the Jewish area. So the idea was, you know, we use the terminology, I wash my hands of this.
Right.
It was kind of like that. They're shaking the dust of the pagan dust off before they go into Jewish territory. So when Jesus says this, what he is saying is basically, you're considering them just as pagans. If they won't listen to the good news of the Jewish Messiah, the promised deliverer for Israel, if they won't listen to that, then shake the dust off your clothes the same way you would if it was a pagan city. They're responsible. So here's the thing. He goes on to say, verse 15, I tell you the truth, the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah will be better off than such a town on the judgment day. Jesus says in another place, to whom much is given, much is required. Once we really hear, remember he used to say, if you have ears to hear, listen to this. Once we really hear the gospel, really hear it, we really understand it, we can't unhear it. And we're responsible. Once we really get a vision, we really see, in a sense, Christ and who he is and what that means, we can't unsee that. Once God reveals the truth to us, we can't make ourselves ignorant anymore. And we are responsible for that. And to whom much is given, much is required. These people are either in the very presence of Christ or they're in the presence of the apostles of Christ. That's a heavy responsibility because, if anybody should be believing, it's these people, right? What are they seeing? They're seeing the apostles of Jesus Christ come into their town, healing the sick, raising the dead, casting out demons. If they don't believe, there's only one reason why they're not believing. It's because of the hardness of their hearts. That's a bad place to be. It's a dangerous place for them to be going, too. Look what he says in verse 16. Look, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves, so be as shrewd as snakes and harmless as doves. That's easy to say, but it's a hard balance for us. It's human nature. We tend to slip into one of into an extreme. Extremes are easy. We don't have to think about extremes. We can just react. And we all tend to do that in life. It's a human tendency. We tend to either become more and more cynical and suspicious, kind of assuming that everyone is out to get us, or at least most people are out to get us. And it's just safer just to assume it's everyone. That way, you know, nobody's going to get me, right? Everyone's out to take advantage of me. Everyone's out to get me. You know, everyone's out to get a little bit more. So I have to make sure that I fight for every inch and, you know, every dollar or whatever, because I don't want to let anyone take advantage of me. And it's easy to start living life that way, which is a very depressing way to live life. On the other hand, we can assume that everybody has my best interests at heart. Everybody's on my side. I can ask anybody for help, and they're going to give me help. I can ask anybody for answers, and they're going to give me wonderful wisdom, right? We can become naive and just, you know, kind of a Pollyanna, if you're familiar with that, expression, kind of a Pollyanna way of looking at life. Everything's wonderful. Everything's happy. Everyone's good, and everyone's going to help me. And that's going to lead to disaster too, right? The balance is a lot harder, but that's where wisdom is. You need to be shrewd as serpents, but harmless as doves. We need to realize that not everyone out there is good. Not everyone out there, not even in a relative sense, not everyone out there has a good intention. But on the other hand, we're not out there just to protect our own and to make sure that no one takes advantage of us and fight fire with fire. We're out there for a purpose. We're out there to do what's beneficial and helpful to them. But beware, for you will be handed over to the courts and will be flogged with whips in the synagogues. You'll stand trial before governors and kings because you are my followers. But let's stop there for a second. It's talking about persecution. Now, in this paragraph, he goes from instructions that are limited to their immediate context, and now he's going to some principles that really carry beyond that, throughout the history of the church, really. This would become a reality to them. Not that they didn't face some persecution in that first trip out. I'm sure they did. I'm sure they ran out of some synagogues, and you know, I'm sure they faced some persecution in some of these communities. But that would become increasingly reality to the early church. We've talked about this. It's been a reality throughout the history of the church, even more so now. And increasingly, the closer and closer we get to the end, whenever that is, I'm not going to set any dates, but the closer and closer we get to the end, the more this will be a reality, the more this kind of persecution. But look what it says. But this will be your opportunity to tell the rulers and other unbelievers about me. When you're arrested, don't worry about how to respond or what to say. God will give you the right words at the right time. For it's not you who will be speaking, it will be the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Isn't that cool? Notice he doesn't say, he says you'll be going to hand over to courts, flogged with whips in the synagogues, you'll stand trial, so they're being arrested, right? And he even says, verse 19, when you're arrested. He doesn't give them any advice on how to escape this, how to get away from it,
right.
How to get out of jail, right?
Right. It's not getting them, yeah.
Why not? What advice does he give?
I think Jesus is giving them a little preview of what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think. Absolutely. Also what will happen to them, too.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, every one of these men, except for John, well, and
Judas.
Are going to give their lives for their faith. Judas gave his life, but not for his faith.
Mm-hmm.
John was willing to give his life, and he came close to giving his life. But what kind of advice does Jesus give him in this situation?
how to be an example in those situations.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, but this will be your opportunity to tell the rulers and other unbelievers about me. That's a very different way of looking at this, isn't it? It's not the way we would normally look at this. You know, can you imagine this kind of a strategy session? Okay, guys, you're going to go out here, you're going to get arrested, you're going to get beaten, you're going to, you know. So you're telling him all this stuff. You know, what's the question, the question that would probably be on all of our minds? All right. How do we avoid getting arrested and beaten and flogged and whipped and, you know, all this stuff? Is it, what's the way out? But he's basically saying, no, this is, in at some point, this is going to be plan A. This is going to be the way it's supposed to work. Because what does this do? It gives us the opportunity to share our faith. How many of us look at persecution as an opportunity to share our faith? When we get into, because of our faith, not because of our own bad, poor decisions or bad actions, but because of our faith, if we get into a tough situation at work, if we get into a situation where it may cost us something to express our faith, maybe in school or in a social setting. Now, I'm not saying being obnoxious and shoving our faith down everybody's throats, but at times, there's a time and a place for us to express our faith, and sometimes it costs us. Do we look at that as an opportunity to share our faith? Even if it could cost us physically, getting beaten and whipped and arrested, possibly killed, we're willing to lay our life on it? He's basically saying, he's turning it completely around. This is a good thing, right? Because if you're being hauled into court because of your faith, you're not really the captive there. They are. Because God is sovereign. He can get us out of anything. Remember when he went in, Peter was arrested, and he sent in an angel, and the chains dropped off, and he took Peter right out? God can get us out of anything he wants to. So in a way, if they arrest us for our faith and put us right in the middle of a trial where we have to account, which is not, in our setting, that's not going to happen anytime too soon. It may happen in the future. It is happening in a lot of places in the world, though. You're front and center in a court having to justify your faith. They are the captive audience. God has just plunked you right down in a whole bunch of people who need to hear the gospel. They are the ones that aren't going anyplace, and so you can, that's what Paul did, right? He was called in front of kings multiple times. What did he do? He shared the faith. He shared the good news. There are three things that they had on their side, and we will too if we end up in this kind of a situation. One is we have the truth. It's amazing how having the truth can give us a calm and a confidence. We don't have to manufacture this. We don't have to. It's not like having, you know, you have your viewpoint, I have my viewpoint, and we're going to fight. No, we can know that this is the truth. And that gives us a real reassurance. And we also have the Spirit within us, giving us the words to say. How many times have we shared something with someone, and afterwards it's like, man, I don't know where that came from, right? God just gives us the word to say. And also, we have the rock-solid assurance that God loves the people who are persecuting us and wants them to come to the faith too. And so he's going to use us right in the midst of that situation to share the faith with the people who are persecuting us. We can look at it from a completely different perspective. If they can even kill us, and that can be victory, that can be success. If we are faithful witnesses, to testify of our faith, to share the good news, to share the gospel with them, even if they kill us, we can still have an impact. We can get it from a very, very eternal perspective rather than a limited perspective. It could be serious, though. Verse 21, a brother will betray his brother to death, a father will betray his own child, and children will rebel against their parents and cause them to be killed. If that sounds like a fairy tale, do some reading about totalitarian situations. Nazi Germany. I remember when I was a kid, I was fascinated by Nazi Germany. There were communist countries also a lot of times. There are family members betraying other family members. And it becomes horrific, but this happens. And all nations will hate you because you are my followers. But everyone who endures to the end will be saved. When you're persecuted in one town, flee to the next. I tell you the truth, the Son of Man will return before you have reached all the towns of Israel. I don't want to go too deeply into this. Jesus is covering a lot of territory, and any of these paragraphs we could spend a lot of time on, but I'm trying to just kind of hit the highlights, and then we're going to wrap it, we're going to bring it all together here at the end. But this can be confusing, so let's stop and talk about this for a minute. That last line there, I tell you the truth, the Son of Man will return, or when you're persecuted in one town, flee to the next. I tell you the truth, the Son of Man will return before you've reached all the towns of Israel. There are two different ways that we need to look at this, and they're both both important. To them then, when Jesus was speaking to them, when he's sending them out on a mission, he's going to go off and do some ministry also. But then when he says, when the Son of Man returns, what would their immediate understanding of that be? When he pulls them back together and comes back and he's with them again, right? So he's basically, the immediate understanding of this is you go out there, and if you have problems, you go on to the next town. And when and you're not going to run out of towns in Israel before, you know, you're back with me. That's the immediate contact. But is there more meaning that we see in there than just that immediate application? Because we know from other prophecies in Scripture that at the very end, there is once again going to be an intense evangelization of the Jewish people. And so we see a deeper context to this. And so there will once again be a time when there will be people being persecuted, but also at the same time evangelizing. And he is saying at that point, again, you're not going to go through all the towns of Israel before I return when that happens.
I have one question about that. Was Israel physically bigger back then than it was today, and that's why he did that in a way?
Well, not exactly. Israel, it was similar to the boundaries it has now, although it was broken up into different. They had Galilee, they had Judea, and they had their territory kind of carved up a little bit back then, even like they do now. So. Yeah, well, and that's part of the reassurance. Now, it's important that we understand something here, though, too. What are they, by going to another town, what are they doing? They're doing two things. They're removing themselves from the persecution in that one town, but they're continuing their mission. And so Jesus is basically giving them kind of a tactic to handle this. You don't have to just stay there and be killed. If you give your life, that's going to happen at times. Jesus talks about that. And we even see this with the life of Paul. If you have a chance to get away from persecution, get away. Continue the ministry someplace else. This ongoing removing yourself from an area of persecution and continuing the ministry elsewhere, that process will not stop until Jesus returns. That's the biggest picture of what we have here. And in immediate context, that's true for them then, and it will be true for those who are evangelizing the Jewish people at the end. Now, this gets into a whole bunch of questions about the end times, the return of Christ, timing a lot. We're not going to get into any of that this morning because it's a wonderful topic, but we don't have time to get into that.
I've got to be home by 3.
Yeah. That wasn't what I was. But, Rich, you had a question?
Yeah, I had a question. I'm going to tag into his question. You asked, why would it take so long? Even though you're in a country that's probably only 15 miles long one way and about 10 wide, it's hilly, and you had to walk wherever you went. And the roads, some existed, some don't. So you got to figure just the logistics of that would be impossible.
Yeah.
It's very appropriate that our logistics ministry leader is sharing with us the logistics of this. That's very, very appropriate. Well, let's continue here, verse 24. Students are not greater than their teacher, and slaves are not greater than their master. Students are to be like their teacher, and slaves are to be like their master. And since I, the master of the household, have been called the prince of demons, the members of my household will be called by even worse names. You get the principle he's establishing here? If we're the students, if we're the slaves, we shouldn't expect to be treated better than the master, than the student, the teacher. In fact, we're going to be treated worse. We're not going to be respected as much. It's interesting, if you follow kind of the conversation that we have as a culture among around religious issues. It's changed a lot. The tone of it has changed a lot in the last decade or two. Used to be, most of you remember this, it used to be that people had a pretty good image, pretty good perception of Jesus. The church, a few decades ago, people even had a mostly a positive perspective of the church. Everyone kind of thought, I should be in church, even if they weren't. Then that kind of changed to where, yeah, Jesus is good, the church I don't know about. In fact, even in the 60s, I think, there were signs that said, Jesus, yes, religion, no, or something like that. And so people had this idea that, Jesus is cool, Jesus is just all right with me, that type of thing. But the church, and that carried for quite a few decades. Now it's become shocking to me, the conversations that I overhear sometimes. Last year, I got to be back in the workplace again after being in full-time ministry for a long time, and that was very interesting, because for a while people, not that I'm trying to hide anything, but for a while people don't know who you are, where you come from, what your background is, what you do, and so people didn't realize that I was a pastor, and so you hear just very candid conversations. It's amazing to me how many conversations were about Jesus in a very negative sense. It's not just religion that a lot of people consider negatively, it's Jesus. And you can just Google Jesus and see even some of the images that are kind of mocking and ridiculing and making fun of Jesus. Used to be that was even kind of considered sacred by non-Christians. It's like, okay, you don't make fun of Jesus. You can make fun of Christians but in the church, but not Jesus. That's changing. And Jesus is even in some circles beginning to be considered an evil influence on humanity. Same way, how like Christopher Columbus and some of the founding fathers have kind of redefined as being an evil type of thing, and I'm not, that's my point has nothing to do with that, but in the same sense, people are redefining, they're re-envisioning their interpretation and impression of Jesus, and a lot of times it's in a very negative way, and they're seeing him as being diabolical and evil. And if that's the way they're seeing Jesus, how are they going to see his followers?
Just the same.
We need to be ready. Now, I'm not trying to be a doomsayer. I'm not trying to get you all frantic and paranoid and freaking out and everything. But it can happen. It's happened in other places in the world. We need to be ready for a time when to be a faithful Christian is to be viewed by society as being evil. Do you know what the most common charge when Christians were executed in the Roman Empire for their faith? Do you know what the most common charge was? They had an official charge that they would execute people for. You know what the most common one was? Hater of humanity. Because they wouldn't be a part of Roman culture. They wouldn't be a part of all the other gods and goddesses and all, they had to be separate from all of that stuff, and so they were considered haters of humanity. They would not be a part of their society. There may come a time when to be a Christian is to be viewed as someone who hates humanity, hates society. We're already seeing that to some extent. As lovingly and graciously as we can, if we hold to biblical standards on certain things, we're considered haters. Even if there's no hatred in our hearts at all. And so we need to be ready to sacrifice our reputation in that sense. Not through our own fault, but just because we're a follower of Jesus Christ. If they called him demonic, if they called him evil, getting his power from the prince of demons, what are they going to say about us? And we need to be prepared for that. But don't be afraid. Verse 26. But don't be afraid of those who threaten you, for the time is coming when everything that is covered will be revealed, and all that is secret will be made known to all. What I tell you now in the darkness, shout abroad from daybreak, when daybreak comes. What I whisper in your ear, shout from the housetops for all to hear. Don't be afraid of those who want to kill your body. They can't touch your soul. Fear only God, who can destroy both soul and body in hell. What is the price of two sparrows? One copper coin? But not a single sparrow can fall to the ground without your Father knowing it. And the very hairs on your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You're more valuable to God than a whole flock of sparrows. What's... We need to understand this. He's not telling them, you need to run away because you're in danger. He is intentionally putting them in harm's way. And he may intentionally put us in harm's way. Is that okay? Well, it's only okay if we are focused on the mission. If it's all about accomplishing the mission, if that's why we're here. If we're here to have a happy life and to grab the golden, you know, the brass ring and try to, got the Olympics on my mind, it has to be the gold ring. You know, go for the gusto and try to get everything we can out of life, then we're going to be really frustrated trying to live the Christian life. But if we are here for the mission, then it puts all of this into perspective. Don't be afraid of people who can only do things to you that are very temporary. They can't do anything to us that's permanent. The most they can do is kill our bodies, but guess what? Our bodies are dying anyway. And that's all they can do is kill an already decaying, dying body. They can't do anything to our spirits. They can't do anything to our souls. And they can't, even if they arrest us and put us in a courtroom or in a prison cell or whatever, they're just putting us where God is allowing us to be anyway, and he's going to use us in the middle of the courtroom or the prison cell. They can't. When the communists took over China, they thought that they would stamp out Christianity. They took all the Christians and they dispersed them throughout the whole, all of China, thinking that they would stamp it out. All they did is they just spread it everywhere. And now the Christian church is possibly stronger in China than anybody else in the world. They cannot do anything to stop the work of God. And if we look at it from that big picture, then we're not going to be as worried about this. God even knows when a sparrow falls. Every hair on our head is numbered. Now that's easier for him, for me, than it is for some others. Not as many hairs up there to number. But he knows.
I got more numbers than you.
But God is more aware of our situation than we are. He's more aware of the danger that we're in and this our situation than we are. But he is willing to allow this because it's all about the mission, and he invites us to be part of his mission. I think that's wonderful. Let's keep going here. We need to wrap this up. Everyone who acknowledges me publicly here on earth, I will also acknowledge before my Father in heaven. But everyone who denies me here on earth, I will also deny before my Father in heaven. Don't imagine that I came to bring peace to the earth. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies will be right in your own household. And again, if that sounds too extreme, then do some homework, because here's the amazing thing. Truth unites, but it also divides. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. And there's only real unity and real harmony and real community and a real brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity in Jesus, in the Prince of Peace. But if someone rejects Jesus, rejects that peace, rejects that unity, opposes and seeks to stamp out and destroy his truth and his peace and his unity, then that brings division. And so by bringing the truth, by shining the light, Jesus was not only causing unity, he was causing division. Because those who will not come to the light, those who will not accept the truth, they reject it. And that division is absolutely necessary. It has to happen. If you love your father or mother more than you love me, you're not worthy of being mine. Or if you love your son or daughter more than me, you're not worthy of being mine. If you refuse to take up your cross and follow me, you're not worthy of being mine. If you cling to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for me, you'll find it. Anyone who receives you receives me. And anyone who receives me receives the Father who sent me. If you receive a prophet as one who speaks for God, you'll be given the same reward as a prophet. And if you receive righteous people because of their righteousness, you will be given a reward like theirs. And if you give even a cup of cold water to one of the least of my followers, you will surely be rewarded. When Jesus had finished giving these instructions to his 12 disciples, he went out to teach and preach in towns throughout the region. So he gives them their instructions, he sends them out, and he goes out himself. If we receive someone because they are from God, we will be rewarded for that. He's not just saying if you give anybody a cup of cold water, you get the reward. Mm-hmm. It's if you receive people because they are a prophet, because they are righteous, because they are the follower of God, the disciple of Christ, then they'll be rewarded. But let's go back up to this, because this we need to focus on as we end here. If you love your father or mother more than you love me, you are not worthy of being mine. Is that too harsh? If we love father or mother more than Christ, what is that? It's idolatry. So Jesus is putting it in very stark terms. If you love your father or mother more than me, you're not worthy of me. We're missing the whole picture. We're not getting it. The ironic thing is we can't really truly love anyone the way God intends us to until we get our love relationship squared away with God, because that's where we get the real love to love other people with in a godly, self-sacrificing way. So we can try to love others more than we love Christ, but ultimately we won't even be able to do that. That's why, you know, people talk about having peace and unity and brotherhood and all that. You know, they've been talking about that for a long time, but we can't accomplish it until we actually come together in Christ. But if you love your father and mother more than you love me, you're not worthy of being mine. If you love your son or daughter more than me, you're not worthy of being mine. That's a little harder, isn't it? That's harder. Keith Green wrote a song years ago, "I Pledge My Head to Heaven for the Gospel." Okay? He's talking about how he wanted to sacrifice himself. Second verse is, "I pledge my wife to heaven for the gospel," and how he's willing, you know, to even entrust her to God. And the third verse was, "I pledge my son to heaven for the gospel. Though he's kicked and beaten, ridiculed and scorned, I will teach him to rejoice and raise a thankful, praising voice, and to be like you, who bore the cross and the crown of thorns. To even be willing to give up our children to God, to trust God that much, to love God more than even a son or a daughter. That's when we are giving all. If you can give your children to God, you're giving everything. Because if we love our children more than we love Christ, what is that? It's idolatry. We cannot place anything above our devotion and our love for God. We need to be willing to sacrifice everything. And that's why he says next, if you refuse to take up your cross and follow me, you're not worthy of being mine. We use this terminology, taking up our cross. It's our cross to bear. We use it in a very petty, trivial way. If someone is having a problem with a coworker and they're just really a jerk, and someone says, "Well, you know, I guess that's just your cross to bear," that's not what he's talking about. What was the cross? It was a form of execution. It was not only a form of death, it was a form of shameful death. We say take up your cross. Jesus said if we have to take up our cross and follow him. Basically, in our modern day vernacular, that'd be like you have to sit in your electric chair and follow God. Basically, it's saying I am willing to give up everything, even my very life. Even if it brings me shame and ridicule before all of society, I'm willing to sacrifice everything, even the way I am perceived, even my reputation. I'm willing to sacrifice it all. I'm willing to lay everything on the line for God. Paul would later write that we are to be living sacrifices. Every day we lay our life on the altar and say, it's all yours. He said, it's no longer I who lives. It's Christ who lives in me. When we accept the sacrifice of Christ for us, we also sacrifice ourselves for Him. He laid His life on the line for us, gave everything for us. And so there comes a point where we, in turn, lay our lives on the line. My old life is dead. It's gone. It's buried. The only life I have is in You. And so, if you cling to your life, you'll lose it. But if you give up your life for Me, you'll find it. If we try to hold on to life, and the more it goes by, sometimes the more desperately we do this, we try to hold on to it, try to get everything out of life we can. And if we do that, we'll lose it. It'll be like trying to hold on to sand at the seashore. You ever do that? And the more you try to hold on to it tightly, the more it slips through your fingers. The writer of Ecclesiastes says it's like trying to grasp oil or trying to chase the wind. And the more we do that, the more elusive it is and the more it escapes us. And the more frustrated and futile it becomes and meaningless it becomes, to where life has no purpose, it has no meaning. Because we're all going to just die anyway. And if you try to hold on to your life, you try to cling to your life, you'll lose it. The amazing thing is, if we give up our life, if we open our hands, lay it all on the line, it's all Yours, God, then we get everything. That's when we really find our lives. That's when we really discover who we are in Him. Who we were always meant to be, who He always created us to be, what it's always been about. If we cling to this church, we will lose it. If we try to protect and preserve and hold on to what we have, we'll lose it. Little by little, drips and drabs, it'll slip through our fingers and we'll end up with nothing. But if we are willing to lay it all on the line, we give it all to You, we'll sacrifice anything that You call us to be who You call us to be only found in You, then we will find life that we don't even understand, can't even anticipate now. But we have to be willing to put it all on the line, to hold nothing back. Are we willing to do that? This morning we're going to end by remembering the sacrifice that Christ made for us. But as we do that, I want us to remember that sharing in the bread and in the cup is not just a way of visually showing everyone and ourselves that we accept Christ's sacrifice for us. It's also a way of giving ourselves back to Him. Saying, I am in You. My life is in You. I'm a part of You, a part of Your people. It's a way of us being a living sacrifice and laying our life on the line. So I invite you this morning to share in communion as a way of remembering Christ, but also a way of recommitting ourselves to Him and to the mission that He has for us as a church. Lord Jesus, You held nothing back. You sacrificed everything for us in ways that I don't know if we'll ever completely comprehend. You paid the ultimate price for us. You took on our death, the consequences of our sin. You paid our debt. And Lord, we will be in wonder about that for eternity. We will thank you for eternity. We will never forget, but always remember the sacrifice that you made for us. That because of taking our death, we can now receive your life. And you call us to live that life to the fullest. But to live your life, we have to relinquish the old. To live your resurrection life, our old lives have to be hammered to the cross with you. Our old lives have to die and be buried. We need to live in your newness of life. We need to take up our cross and follow you. To lay everything on the line. To hold nothing back. Not our parents. Not our children. Nothing in our lives. Not this church. Lord, we lay everything on the line for you. Help us to look to you, not to anything that we have, but only to you. All life flows from you. You are the source of all. We trust you with everything, Lord, without reservation, without hesitation. We lay it all on the line. You are our life. And help us, we pray, to live that life to the fullest. For your glory. To bless each other. And to accomplish the mission you have given us. To reach out to the world around us with your love and your grace and your truth. To shine the light in the darkness. To be a part of the invasion. To carry life into death. Help us to be faithful, we pray. Help us to be like you. In your name we pray.